So one of the very important areas of practice is effort, is what kind of effort to make. But just as important as the topic of effort is the topic of effortlessness. And to be wise, understanding about what is it that's effortless in the practice? How does what is effortless manifest and show itself in the practice? And there's a interplay between effort and effortlessness. And certainly practice can take a lot of effort. But if it's only effort, then the deeper or the fuller potential of the practice won't have a chance to surface. There has to also be an allowing of something to emerge. There has to be space or kind of space maybe or room for something to arise which is effortless in the sense that it's not our doing. There's what we do and there's what we allow for. And this idea of allowing for things to surface, to emerge, to show themselves, allowing things to move through us, and not being always in control of what happens is a very important part of practice. We have that which we can control, and we have that which we allow for. And doesn't have to be one or the other. They both can be there together. But without one without the other probably is not very supportive for the overall unfolding of the practice. One of the characteristics of how the Buddha taught practice was that he did not talk about the progress of practice from the point of view of a self, but rather he tended to talk about it in ways that belong to the discussion of conditions. We create the conditions for something to arise. And we have some choice about what arises depending on what conditions we put in place. So here on the retreat, we're given tasty food. And if you go back for fifths and your belly is just completely distended and you can't believe how much food and you can almost hardly waddle back to your room, that's the condition for uncomfortable meditation. It might be a condition for drowsy meditation or distracted meditation. It creates a condition for something. If, on the other hand, you eat just enough to be satisfied, but not enough to get all the pleasure you might want from the food, but enough to be contented and well-fed, that might be create the conditions of coming back to sit and have greater clarity, to be more alert and present. So we have some choice about what we do. And in many, many ways, we engage in this choice. So on retreat like this, one of the choices we make is to have it mostly be a silent retreat. And that creates the condition over time of the mind, helping the mind settle more quickly than if we were involved in a lot of social conversation the whole week. And as the mind quiets down, that's a condition for seeing some of the depth of our mind, how we operate and what motivates us, and seeing all kinds of qualities, and seeing perhaps the mind's capacity for understanding, for wisdom, for caring, for all kinds of things can arise as the mind quiets down. If we decide instead to spend this week, since it is an election season, and debate the virtues of the various people running for president, it might be a good way of spending our week. but chances are that your mind is not going to get so subtle, and it creates the conditions for something else. Maybe it creates the condition more likely of being agitated. And so we're choosing to have a certain conditions here that support a certain kind of direction of the mind. And so over and over again, what we're doing in practice is create the conditions so something can emerge and unfold. And you'll see in a minute that this is kind of a big emphasis in the Buddha's teachings. So what it implies is there has to be both creating conditions, but also a willingness to not take full responsibility for everything, not to ride your experience and judge your experience and all the time, and not to fill your mind with self-evaluation and self-criticism or self-praise and all the things around self, but to somehow be willing to create room, breathing room, for something to unfold, something to emerge, which is not something you're making happen, and not something you're willing, forcing to happen, and it's not something you're making happen. But you're creating conditions so it may arise, Dharma willing. And I like to think of from my own practice, being a teacher, I like to believe, I kind of like to say it this way, that the Dharma knows better what needs to happen than you do. So this willingness to kind of get out of the way, to see what's there and allow it to emerge. And sometimes it's not pretty. Sometimes there's a lot of unresolved issues or feelings that need to bubble up, and we make space for that. But also some of the maturation of practice, the way that individuals mature, the psychological changes that occur, also require making space for it, and that also needs a time to bubble up and to emerge and to surface. So this idea of allowing the practice to move through you, to allowing the practice to unfold, by rather than making it unfold, helps us to kind of get out of the way of our own, get out of our own way. And we allow a natural process to unfold. And this idea that there's a natural process that's inside of you, that if you allow, can unfold, is very supportive. So the Buddha gave a variety of analogies for this natural process. One was that of a farmer cultivating plants, growing plants. The farmer doesn't make the plants grow. The farmer's not out there pulling and tugging at the plants and stretching them. But rather, the farmer creates the conditions for the plant to grow. The farmer plants a seed, and then waters it, protects it, fertilizes it, whatever is needed, and then that plant, given the best conditions, the plant grows the best possible way. So in the same way, we cultivate our inner life. We cultivate, care for, tend to our heart and to our mind, to create the conditions that allow the best that's in there to come forth. And it's a very positive view of human nature that if you create the right conditions, something really beautiful will emerge inside of you. And the word beautiful is a word which became a favorite word in the Buddhist tradition for the good qualities that we have inside of ourselves, beautiful qualities. So it's kind of a positive recognition of something nice here that we all have, if nothing else, has a potential. The other analogy the Buddha gave was that of a hen sitting on her eggs. When the hen is sitting on the eggs, the hen is not making the chick inside of the embryo inside the egg grow and develop. But the chicken is creating the conditions for the egg to develop into a chick. And then the Buddha said, even if the chicken wished that the chicks did not hatch, they would hatch. Even if if the right conditions are in place for your spiritual growth, even if you don't want to grow, you will, in spite of yourself. Isn't that nice? Even if you want to, even if you don't want. So there's tremendous, tremendous emphasis on the conditions, putting certain conditions in place. And the last analogy I'll mention is that that's used often in the suttas, is that of rainwater flowing down a hill, down a mountain. So it rains enough, then eventually the little raindrops are joined together and make teeny little, you know, little trickles of water. And then those trickles join and they become little creeklets, and the creeklets become creeks, and the creeks become streamlets, and the streams become streams, and the streams become riverlets, and they become rivers, and eventually become a big river, and eventually flows out into the ocean. And the water will flow downhill naturally because of gravity, unless there's an obstruction, unless something blocks it. And so someone who wants water to flow downhill, their job would be not to make the water flow downhill, but rather to let the natural process of flowing occur by removing the obstruction. So there's a big rock, for example, they'd move the rock. And then nature takes its course and the water flows down. And this analogy of is one that the Buddha used, as I said, repeatedly to describe how practice unfolds for people. That there's a series of things that mature progressively as we go on, and that one naturally leads to the next. And the word naturally is how Bhikkhu Bodhi translates the word dhammata. So he uses the word naturally for this unfolding. And I want to read you one description of this unfolding, natural unfolding. And remember, the chicken could even wish that the egg does not hatch. Here, it doesn't say that way. It says that if no volition, if no intention is made, this unfolding would still occur because the conditions are in place. For a virtuous person, one whose behavior is virtuous, no volition need be made. Let non-regret arise in me. It is natural that non-regret arises in a virtuous person, one whose behavior is virtuous. So then it keeps going. For one who is without regret, no volition need be made. Let joy arise in me. It is natural for joy to arise in one without regret. And then I'll abbreviate the rest. It is natural for rapture to arise in one who is joyful. It is natural for one with a rapturous mind to be tranquil, to become tranquil. It is natural for one tranquil in body to feel happy. It is natural that the mind that one it is natural that the mind of one who feels happy is concentrated. It is natural that one who is concentrated knows and sees things as they are. It is natural that one who knows and sees things as they are becomes disenchanted and dispassionate. It is natural for one who is disenchanted and dispassionate to realize knowledge and vision of liberation. So it's kind of, and then in talking about this particular teaching, the Buddha then likened it to this, the rainwater going down the mountain. And to make the connection really explicit, I think there are 9 or 10 different steps in this description, and there's exactly the same number of steps for where rainwater becomes, it goes into the ocean, becoming, you know, a bigger and bigger river as it goes down. But this process has a beginning. You know, you just don't kind of just sit and watch TV and just wait for it to happen. And certain conditions have to be in place, so this, the mind's, the heart's capacity to unfold has a chance to do so. In this description here, it's being virtuous, you know, living a virtuous life, an ethical life, a life of integrity. In another discourse, it's having confidence, something that's called confirmed confidence, in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, as well as in virtue, the value of virtue. And so with this kind of confidence in place, it says the practice will flow naturally to the ending of our attachments. The word here is taints. A discourse that I'm very fond of is one called The Simile of the Cloth, where it describes how a person gets a confirmed confidence in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. And what's nice about this is it's to have that confirmation that the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha is valuable. It comes from one's own experience of practice, looking at one's own mind. So you don't have to read a book, you're not kind of believing someone out there, but you really see, it's like you see, oh yeah, that's what they're talking about. Now I know. Something inside of us resonates then with what Buddha, Dharma, Sangha is. And I hope that a good number of you, having been experienced practitioners practicing for a while, that there's been some intuition, something that you've discovered that is a reference point for you, that you can say, yes, there is something in this Buddha, Dharma, Sangha thing. There's something I know for myself that I find valuable. So in this simile of the cloth, the Buddha describes as, if you have an imperfection of the mind, and probably in modern California we'd say, if you have a minor shortcoming in your mind, then and you know it, you see that imperfection, and then you're able to abandon it, you're able to let go of it, you're able to let it kind of dissolve or fade away, and you have an experience of the mind without it. That experience, something there, imperfection, some kind of something, a painful tendency of the mind, if you know it and know when the mind is free of it, that experience is what this text says gives confirmed confidence in the Buddha. So it's not some complicated philosophy, it's not something, you know, mysterious and mystical. It's something very simple, maybe not easy, but very simple. And maybe some of you have had some experience of the lessening or the disappearing, maybe for a period of time, of some of the painful tendencies, habits of your own mind, the ways you get caught up and swirl around. And you've seen it fade away, or you've seen it stop, And it's been such a relief. It's been so nice to have that absence of those things. And it's easy for people who have a long to-do list to not really take time and notice that absence of something and to simply go on to the next neurosis because, you know, there are important things to do. But then we're not giving breathing room, we're not making space to appreciate, to take in, to be informed by how we are changed. And maybe there's not any opportunity to feel inspired by what's happened to us. Oh, this is good. This is great. And so with this kind of confirmed confidence through our own experience, then the expectation in the text is that gives birth to delight or gladness. And I don't know how automatic it is for most of us to do that, but it can be relatively natural or automatic if we understand that it's okay to allow ourselves to be glad or happy or joyful about that. This is really nice that I'm no longer caught up in those things. If we're kind of given the instruction that it's okay, but not only is it okay, but take a little bit of time to allow yourself to feel the goodness or the delight or the sense of well-being that's there when something that bothered us a lot in our minds is no longer there. And if we do that, then maybe it can feel like saying that, of course you feel happy. And maybe you'll feel happy more often by recognizing, oh yeah, this is good. And then it says, for someone who is glad, joy is born. It doesn't say someone who's glad then makes themselves joyful. It's this natural process again that unfolds with certain conditions. With gladness there, joy is born. When a person is joyous, the body becomes tranquil. Again, it doesn't say that we relax our body. The body becomes tranquil when there's a certain kind of joy. And then when the body is tranquil, there arises happiness. And for someone who is happy, so someone who's happy becomes concentrated. It doesn't say that they then start huffing and puffing and make themselves concentrated. Concentration arises as a natural state from that. So this idea of a natural unfolding. And sometimes then it continues beyond concentration in some of these texts, and the natural unfolding is to see things as they are. And sometimes the natural unfolding is described as moving into loving kindness, compassion arises. Because sometimes, depending on the conditions around us, different things can kind of bubble up. And it's sometimes what happens is we feel tremendous feelings of love in that space. And that's what has a chance to emerge. Sometimes it's deepening states of concentration that we enter and abide in. Very still, very quiet. And then over time, as this process unfolds, some people describe it kind of like practice builds like a snowball going downhill. It gets bigger and bigger. Practice grows. At some point, then, there's liberation. But as far as I know, I don't think the Buddha ever describes how exactly liberation occurs. But when he describes his own liberation, he describes how he became aware that he was liberated. Isn't that nice? And then maybe that's because liberation also is a conditioned phenomenon. The conditions have to be in place, or to say it a little differently, all kinds of conditions have to be not around. It has the absence of conditions. And then the heart can release itself. The heart can feel at home in itself. The heart can finally kind of turn itself inside out to be unprotected, or be open, or be deeply kind of settled. Or the heart can let go of itself. Because the heart or the mind, there's a kind of subtle way in which we hold on. And it takes a tremendous trust to relax and open and let the heart let go of itself and have this wonderful experience of liberation and freedom. So I think it's a very remarkable description of the progress of practice that it doesn't require us to make the progress, but rather create the conditions for it. But that doesn't mean that we can just kind of take it easy. The Buddha also emphasized the importance of putting a lot of effort into practice. Tremendous effort. Maybe the effort to keep taking the obstructions away from the water flowing downhill so it can keep flowing. In fact, if you look at the descriptions of what the practices the Buddha gave, when he gave when he described a course of practice, a series of practices to do that lead to liberation, there are those practices you do before the natural process begins to unfold. So it's not expected that you can just sit down and say, okay, take over, Dharma. I'm along for the ride. I've known people who've done that, and it was kind of magical thinking. One person I know was kind of angry with the whole Dharma scene and Dharma and practice and all that, because she believed that if she went on a lot of retreats, just sat there, she would get enlightened. Something would happen. And it was kind of a magical thinking. She didn't have any sense of what she was supposed to be responsible for and how to engage and the kind of effort she was supposed to make. So in these path descriptions the Buddha gives, there's the practices we do that create the conditions to allow this natural process to unfold. And it might take a lot of effort to create those conditions. Just like for some of you, I think it took a lot of effort to come on retreat. That was part of the whole retreat experience, all the effort it took to get ready and put things aside and whatever you had to do, travel long ways. So I wanted to show you or tell you about one sequence of the practices that we're supposed to do that lead up to this natural process. And this one's a relatively short one. So the first one is to be restrained by virtue. To restrain one's behavior to be virtuous. The second, next step, is to what's called, I call it safeguarding the sense doors. Guarding the sense doors. The third is to be mindful and clearly aware. The fourth is to be content. And the fifth is to abandon the hindrances. So what's interesting about this list is that it's mostly about two things. What you don't do and what you know. Restraining yourself by virtue means you avoid unvirtuous activities. So you avoid doing certain things. You don't kill, steal, such things. Guarding the sense doors means that you're careful that your mind doesn't get involved, entangled with what you can see, hear, taste, touch, smell, that the experiences that come in through the senses. So it's practicing such a way to avoid doing something more than doing something. One way to understand this is you're trying to avoid putting up the rocks in front of the stream to block the flow. And then the next one, mindfulness and clear awareness, is just knowing what's there clearly, being aware of what's actually happening. I guess being contented is not quite this one of those, but being contented is mostly not being discontented with what one has. Avoiding discontentment. Just whatever you have. You have a roof over your head, you have clothes, you have warmth, you have food. You have the basics of life. As I've said often enough, I still love this example of that. At least for me, that's occasionally I haven't been able to sleep in the middle of the night, and for a while I used to bug me a lot. I used to be anxious and concerned and distressed and thinking this was terrible. And then I decided, since I kind of into this mindfulness thing, to kind of look and see what's going on here. And what I noticed was that most of my distress had to do with the projected consequences the next day. And something somehow wouldn't go right the next day because I'd be too tired. I didn't know what the next day was going to be like, but you know, I kind of was living this fantasy of the next day. And then if I noticed how I actually was now in bed, I was warm, I was well fed, I was peaceful, no one was asking anything of me. Nothing I had to really do in the moment. And then I would learn to just lay there and be contented. Or I would be contented because I realized this is actually pretty good. And then my mind would throw up, reasons for why. Not exactly a reason for why, but give me reasons for why I shouldn't lay there contented. This issue, that issue, whatever, you know. And then I remember, oh, wait a minute. Those issues are not happening now. They're not here. They involve the creative ability of the mind to project into the future or to remember the past. Things are good right now. And then I'd feel contented until the mind tried its next thing. The mind, you know, is kind of unrelenting sometimes, you know, all this, that probably some of you realize that today. But to be contented mostly by kind of realizing that things are good, sometimes, not always, but things are good. You know, some of you were in the same stop-and-go traffic coming over 17 as I was yesterday, and I enjoyed myself yesterday in that traffic. I was relaxed and contented, and you know, I was actually kind of, I've been in traffic where I felt, same kind of traffic, and I felt frazzled, anxious, impatient. And maybe because I was coming here, I was more predisposed. Okay, look, this is what's happening. Maybe the retreat had already started. So I was content to just be there in the car. So first is restraining ourselves from unvirtuous behavior, not doing those, removing those boulders from the stream. And then there is safeguarding the sense doors so we don't put up boulders to block the water flowing. And then there's this knowing and seeing. And I think of the knowing, of being aware, mindfulness, clear comprehension, I think of it as like creating breathing room for things to unfold. It's like creating open space in which the water can flow. There's something about mindfulness or awareness that kind of doesn't interfere with what is being known. In and of itself, to be mindful, there's no expectations, no demands, no resistance, no judgments about what's being experienced. What's being experienced can be there in its own right. Just like this, present. And then perhaps this being contented also is mostly about what you don't do. Maybe it's natural to be contented if you just, in many situations, if you just kind of relax with it. And then the last one is abandoning the hindrances. And probably for meditators, this is, you know, one of the big tasks, is to first recognize the hindrances are there, develop a wise relationship to them, and then learn to let go of them, or learn to prevent them from arising. So this morning I mentioned the importance of not being in conflict with anything. So I think not being in conflict with your headache, with your knee pain and back pain, not being in conflict with your impatience, not being in conflict with your strong desire and aversions, means to clearly recognize it, kind of practice this allowing, making space for it, breathing room for it, so that awareness kind of lets it be there in an open way, but not participating in it, not indulging in or getting wrapped up in it, but kind of making space. Oh, it's like this. This is what's happening now. It's almost like we get out of the way of it, rather than we get more involved. So the nature of awareness and mindfulness, just to know it, it's like this, not to be in conflict. So we have our work to do, and then when that work comes to a certain point, it's created the conditions to allow a natural process to unfold. And probably some of you have experienced some of this, that you've felt at some point in the course of a retreat, something shifted or opened or settled or resolved or fell away, and you felt not so troubled by what was troubling you, if not so caught up, not so the mind wasn't so busy and active and preoccupied, and there was a degree of calm or subtleness or intimacy or connectedness, or finally feel, I'm here. Where have I been the last 4 days? But it's so good, now I'm finally here. And it can feel really good to finally be here, kind of like grounded and rooted and embodied and present for our lived life, rather than, you know, having the mind kind of, the mind, you know, our minds were taken over by the pirates. Just to sit and be here. I think the simplest way of talking about our responsibility and what we do in this process is to show up. Keep showing up. Keep showing up for the practice. Keep showing up for our experience. The second biggest thing we do, I think, is to then recognize what is here. What is here? What's happening? And then to learn to get out of the way. As I mentioned earlier, the Buddha described this whole natural process without any reference to the self. Now you'll have this, now this will happen, now you'll experience this. The self, the whole idea of self doesn't come into play, oddly enough, happily enough, in this process of unfolding. And often, self-talk, self-preoccupation, self-direction in the practice is just another other boulder blocking the stream. Self-criticism, oh, I'm such a bad meditator. I'm doing the wrong thing. I'm somehow bad. Or, wow, I'm like the hottest meditator in Santa Cruz today. I'm like, I hope no people are noticing how good I am. I'm like the freest person on the planet. People better notice. You know, so kind of, you know, all this kind of self-talk, you know, me referencing to myself, it actually kind of interrupts the flow. And it kind of dams up a beautiful natural flow of energy, of life through us. And so we're willing to use awareness, knowing, mindfulness, as a way of stepping out of, making breathing room for it all, so that our life can flow. What is here can unfold and reveal itself. And to trust that process of revelation, to trust that process of emergence, what emerges in our experience. Sometimes it's our unresolved issues that need to have time in the sun, and sometimes it's our undiscovered beauty, undervalued positive qualities that can begin surfacing and bubbling up and unfolding. So there's a great opportunity to show up and not ride your experience really tightly, not measuring everything that's happening, like that's desperately important to make progress and desperately important to do something or get rid of something, but to show up to what's here and then kind of like get out of the way so you can see it more fully, to allow it there, to see it, let it kind of unfold. And the art of it is to let it unfold without making stories about it, without identifying with it, without believing it or disbelieving it, without getting involved. Just kind of like you step back and you look at it from a distance, or kind of like you get a bird's eye view of it all, and you're not in it, caught in it, but you're allowing it there. And some of the things that are very uncomfortable to be present for inside will resolve themselves if we are aware of them, clearly aware of them, see them, hold them in the space of awareness, but also get out of the way for them. So many of the problems we have won't get solved this way, but they might dissolve. And to allow these things to dissolve and to fade away, to allow them to surface, to wash through us, and wash away. So finally, I'd like to say that it's a very fortuitous condition to be on a retreat with people who have had lots of retreat experience. And there is a atmosphere here, or presence here, or a ambience that's here with how people are practicing, that perhaps you can open to and be present in so that it can support and nourish something in here, an opening, a freeing in here. Because this practice is not about limiting oneself, but it's about really becoming unlimited. That's more the movement of opening up and becoming unlimited, not limited. So to say of allowing, being mindful and aware and allowing and trusting it's okay to allow things to emerge. Trusting in some deep, deep way that if we're mindful and clearly aware, whatever is happening through us is the Dharma unfolding, is our healing, our resolving, our freeing that it takes. So it's the custom here, in retreats often, to end a talk by everyone kind of going back into meditation posture as a way of really, if you're not already, to really reconnect to that space of meditation, of mindfulness, of presence. So you're prepared to continue with the practice.